Hi, Michaela Lafrac here. The podcast you are about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Social media can be a place for kids to connect with one another, watch funny videos, or learn to dance. But as parents or teens probably know, it can also be a place of bullying or constant self-comparison. Just last week, the state of Vermont announced it's suing Meta, the tech company that owns Instagram, Facebook, and WhatsApp. It claims Meta purposefully got children and teenagers addicted to its platforms. And it says the company did this to maximize advertising revenue. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by a psychiatrist who works with kids and teens and has seen social media's effects on them firsthand. We'll also hear from a college student who's lived it. But first, Vermont's Attorney General Charity Clark joins me in the studio to tell us about this new lawsuit and the case against Meta. Attorney General Clark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Attorney General, I'd like to start with some logistics around this lawsuit. Vermont, along with six other states and D.C., have filed lawsuits against Meta in their own state courts. And then separately, 33 states have filed a joint federal lawsuit. Florida filed another federal lawsuit against Meta. Can you talk us through, like, why these are all happening at the same time? Was there coordination? And why Vermont chose the path that it did?
Sure. So there has been an investigation taking place among all these states for the past 2 years. And ultimately, different states decided to take different approaches. We took the approach we took, which is to sue in state court here in Vermont, because we wanted to be in charge of our own suit. We were a leader on the investigation. We feel really strongly about this issue and protecting Vermonters, especially young Vermonters. And we know the case law in Vermont and believe that it's favorable to our position in the case.
Okay. So there are laws at both the federal and the state level that protect consumers broadly and protect children and their privacy. And in the federal suit, the attorneys general assert that Meta violates the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. I know that is separate from what the Vermont lawsuit is, but I am wondering if you could give us a brief overview of what that is.
So what we didn't sue on that
right.
statute. So we sued on the Vermont Consumer
exactly.
Protection Act. So why don't I just provide an overview of that. There are two prongs to the Vermont Consumer Protection Act. The first is deception, which is familiar to all of us because we're all consumers. So we kind of know when someone is not being truthful with us in the marketplace. And the allegation here is that Meta knew and knows that its platform is harmful, but it is continuing this narrative that it isn't harmful and that it's safe for young people. The second prong of the Consumer Protection Act is this unfairness prong. And the unfairness prong has case law that unpacks what that means. And it's things like offends public policy, is oppressive or immoral or unscrupulous, or it causes significant harm to consumers. So we are arguing on that front that Meta designed its platform to elicit excessive and compulsive use by users, especially young users, and it knew about it. It knew that it was doing that. It did it on purpose.
Hmm. How do you prove something like that?
Well, interestingly, Meta itself conducted a study, and it was leaked to the Wall Street Journal. So we have information about that study.
That was in 2021.
Yeah, and it has a number of upsetting statistics, one of which is that Instagram makes body image issues worse for 1 in 3 teen girls. So, you know, that one's compelling. A few others that I found really compelling relating to true harm were that among teens who wanted to kill themselves, 6% said the feeling started on Instagram. And of teens who wanted to hurt themselves, 9% said the feeling started on Instagram. Hmm.
And these are from Meta studies?
Yes.
Okay. I guess my question here, like, that sounds like very, very compelling evidence. But I've also, you know, I've been reading articles from folks who study these types of cases very closely, who are concerned that this is an uphill battle from the states who are part of the federal lawsuit and from the individual states like Vermont who have also filed in their own states to prove this direct causation. Are there any concerns about that? I mean, this is a taxpayer funded lawsuit. It's going to take a lot of time, and you're going up against one of the biggest tech giants in the world.
I mean, when you list all of those states that have taken action as a result of this investigation, I mean, you have a lot of information about how confident we are in our approach. The other thing to keep in mind is that recall how long it took for states to act against the tobacco companies. And there was a time when we didn't realize that smoking tobacco was really bad for you, and doctors were smoking themselves in hospitals and things like that. I mean, these things take time. I wonder if some people are saying, you know, this, you know, doesn't really seem like a compelling case. They are misinformed, unlike those of us who have been a part of this investigation, or it's just Instagram is so new and they haven't really realized, no, this is really happening. This harm is real. It's quantifiable. And what I have learned since we have brought this lawsuit by the feedback that I'm getting is that a lot of people already sensed that this harm was occurring, that the addictive nature of Instagram was real because it felt that way to them as users.
Hmm. Well, I think, yeah, that's the interesting part of this is that I think, you know, when people see the headlines about these types of lawsuits, a lot of us, I know I do, go, oh, yeah, it doesn't always feel good to be on social media. But feeling that feeling is different than having to go into a court of law and prove it. And I'm wondering if you, I know this is an active lawsuit, but is there data that you can share that kind of helps prove that point? Like, for example, do we know how many teens in Vermont are using Instagram?
Well, we have unfortunately had to redact a lot of the complaint. We have this very long 117-page complaint, and a lot of it is redacted because under the terms of the investigation, we had to redact it. So I'm reluctant to delve too deeply into the information that we have. But normally when that occurs, eventually it's unredacted. And I hope that in this case that does take place eventually and hopefully earlier rather than later.
I was going to ask you about the redactions. Yeah. In preparing for this conversation, looking through the lawsuit, there's very large portions that are completely blacked out. For example, a section about how Meta directed its business model at Vermont specifically is almost entirely redacted, including details on the scope of young Vermonters' Instagram use. Are those redactions a typical part of a lawsuit like this?
I think that, I mean, I don't know, typical might be a strong word, but that's definitely not uncommon. We've done this before. And in those cases, eventually we are able to unredact the complaint and refile it. So I hope that in this case, we'll be able to do that as well.
Mm. Attorney General Clark, what is the ultimate goal of this lawsuit, the best case scenario?
What we want is for the harm to stop. That's the best case scenario, is injunctive relief that allows the harm to stop. We've also asked for monetary relief. We've asked for our attorney's fees, our investigation fees, things like that. And we've also asked for what the Consumer Protection Act allows for, which is a $10,000 penalty for each violation. And that would be for each consumer using Instagram. It would be up to $10,000 is what the law provides. And that's what we've asked for here.
Each consumer using, okay, so how would you, would people have to apply or tell you that they're a part of it? How does that work?
We would get the information from Instagram about how many users are in Vermont and, you know, make a calculation, and that's what we would ask the court for.
Mm. And Attorney General, what are the next steps in this suit, and what are you keeping an eye on with the other suits that have been filed against Meta?
Something that has been really heartwarming almost is to see the collaboration among the states, regardless of political affiliation. the states have been almost entirely united about this and even about the details. I mean, all the states are really focused on the injunctive relief, making the harm stop. And that has been a really positive outcome, just as an aside. But just to walk through the next steps of any lawsuit, you know, you file a complaint. That's what happens when you file a lawsuit. You file that long document you referenced. And then the other side, the defendants get to file an answer. Often at that time, they will also file a motion to dismiss to say, nope, the law is not on your side. It's on my side. And so, you know, we don't know if that's what's going to happen. Often that is what happens. And then after that, you begin the process called discovery, where information and documents are exchanged, depositions take place, which is basically an interview that's sworn. And all of that information gathering and document gathering will help you build your case or your defense, depending on what side you're on. So we're just, you know, proceeding with the understanding that that's what this is going to look like going forward. Of course, we are just taking care of this one suit in Vermont, and Meta is juggling all of these suits across the country. So we'll stay in coordination with other attorneys general across the nation and really see how it goes from here.
Mm. Juggling, but amongst, I can only assume, many, many, many lawyers.
Yes.
Yes. Well, in response to the lawsuits, Meta recently issued a statement saying the company is, quote, disappointed, and I'm quoting in full here, instead of working productively with companies across the industry to create clear, age-appropriate standards for the many apps that teens use, the attorneys general have chosen this path, the company said. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm disappointed, too. You know, it would have been great if we could have resolved this before we got to the point of filing a lawsuit. But here we are. And, you know, to make, you know, to just hone in on one thing you said there is in our lawsuit, we even point out that they are not taking age verification seriously. So, you know, let's start there. There's many, many things that they could be doing without our having to file a lawsuit, and they've chosen not to.
Mm. Not taking age verification seriously. What does that mean?
Well, you're not supposed to be on Instagram if you're under 13. And, you know, we include that information on our lawsuit that they're really not taking that seriously.
Mm. Are there ways, not to make you solve their problems for them, but can you explain that a bit more to folks? I mean, I know you have to put your name and your date of birth in when you sign up for an Instagram account. What are ways that they could keep you from lying?
You know, they have done incredible things. I'm sure they can fix this too. And, you know, Vermont children and parents and all of us deserve them. We deserve that. We deserve to have a platform that is safe and isn't creating these incredible harms. I mean, there is a mental health crisis, especially among teens all across this country. And there is a correlation between their mental health, especially girls, and Instagram. Mm. Can I talk about one element of that in particular?
Please.
Probably the most harmful and common is negative social comparison, which we all experience. But among teens, it's very acute. And the thing that is so compelling is that because Instagram, while we experience it as a social media platform, it's really an advertising platform. They collect our data and our interests, and they use that to sell us ads, they sell others ads. We're the product, you know? And with negative social comparison, they show us more of the type of content that we are interested in. So if we're going down a dark rabbit hole, that's what they're going to keep showing us. Mm-hmm. So if someone has an eating disorder and we're intrigued by this content that is harmful to us, we're going to keep looking at it. And the algorithm doesn't have a moral judgment. It just keeps showing us the thing that we keep wanting to look at.
Mm.
And that is very harmful, but especially to young people and especially teen girls.
Yeah. Well, again, not to continue to reiterate this point, but I still wonder how you go about proving that X type of content in you know, this rabbit hole that you've been pushed down is harmful, while this other type of content is simply a company legally showing you content that you might be interested in.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say a lot about what we already know, but we certainly are going to be taking the time in this lawsuit to further build our case based on a 2-year investigation. We already have a lot of that information that we need, and we'll be continuing. One thing that I've really appreciated is since the lawsuits were announced, the conversation has really been elevated. People are talking about this. I, you know, had a family brunch over the weekend, and we were talking a lot about it with my teenage niece and nephew and hearing their perspective and their use. And I think that that's always a good thing. We want to make sure that we're putting tools in place to protect ourselves. As Attorney General, you know, one of my tools is bringing a lawsuit against a bad actor, and that's what we've done here. But I really have appreciated the conversations that are taking place. I think they're so important. And also, as I mentioned, this sense that there is a problem. People already sense that. This isn't a surprise to people. And, you know, it's now's a great time to be thinking about your own social media use or how your children are using Instagram and to take measures to protect yourself. It is designed to be addictive. And if you are experiencing that, you know, reach out and put a plan in place to help protect yourself.
And has working on this lawsuit, preparing for this time, changed either your own behaviors or the ways that you talk to your kid, your nieces and nephews, people in your family?
I think the thing that has changed for me is the experiences that I were having to realize that they were designed to be that way. And now I feel like I can almost intellectualize when I'm encountering, you know, I'm doom scrolling, and I'll give you a couple of examples. One of the design features is what's called infinite scroll. And that is when, you know, you see the post you're interested in, it's your sister's barbecue, yay. But just beneath it, you see the beginning of the next post. You see who posted it, and it looks like, is it a sunny sunset? I don't know what it is, but you're like,
and you blink and it's 1 a.m.
And you die. Exactly. Exactly. So knowing that those are tricks that are put in place to keep my eyeballs scrolling, to keep selling those ads, I think has helped me reflect on my own interaction with the platform. Infinite scroll really got me. Ephemeral content is another trick that they use, and that is content that disappears after a certain amount of time. So on Instagram, there's the stories that disappear after 24 hours, and that keeps you wanting to return, and so you don't miss anything. This fear of missing out, or FOMO, I never thought I would file a complaint in court that actually used the term FOMO, but it's real, and it's a tool that's used to keep people, especially young people, you know, plugged in to their Instagram accounts.
Well, lastly, Attorney General, do you think Vermont will be filing or be part of other lawsuits aimed at tech companies like Meta? They're certainly not the only one operating in this space.
Yeah, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. And we certainly have a policy where we don't acknowledge investigations that we have going on or talk about them. However, one such investigation is already public, and that is against TikTok. Mm-hmm. And we don't know where that will take us. But I, of course, have concerns about the way that other social media platforms are using these same tricks to keep people scrolling and create this excessive and compulsive use.
Mm. Charity Clark is Vermont's Attorney General. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you're just joining us, we are discussing the lawsuits against Meta, the tech company that owns Instagram, and how they target teens. Last year, approximately 62% of U.S. teens aged 13 to 17 used Instagram, according to the Pew Research Center. Meta itself has studied how excessive Instagram use can harm young users' mental health. Now, regardless of whether Meta can and should be held at fault, that harm exists. Oftentimes, it's up to mental health professionals to support young people through it. Folks like Dr. Jeremiah Dickerson, who's joining me for the rest of this hour. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Vermont Larner College of Medicine and a practicing child and adolescent psychiatrist. Dr. Dickerson, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, Dr. Dickerson, when you work with tweens and teens, how often does social media come up in your conversations with them?
It's coming up more and more often, especially in that age group. I think I would be surprised if an adolescent in Vermont is not using social media, thinking about sort of all the platforms that are out there. So it's coming up pretty often, and I think it's incumbent on a lot of us who work with kids and teenagers to start asking questions about social media and the role that it's playing, especially in the lives of tweens and teenagers. Mm.
And in what context does it come up?
For me, I work a lot with autism spectrum disorder and neurodiversity. And so it's interesting to think about where certain teenagers, kids and parents too, are getting information about diagnoses, about mental health. And often it's coming up that kids are searching for certain aspects of sort of diagnostic information through social media platforms online. And so it's really interesting to get a sense of where children and teenagers are getting their information when they come into the office.
Because on the one hand, you could say that, you know, it's great that kids can, you know, if they're feeling anxious or depressed or struggling with another issue, that they could perhaps find information directly on social media. But you're saying that information isn't always accurate and can sometimes even be harmful.
Yeah, the information isn't always accurate, especially when you think about where it's coming from. And often I think teenagers are looking to certain influencers to get that information. So it's definitely not coming, I think, most of the time from professionals.
Mm. Now, the lawsuit from Vermont that we were just speaking about with Attorney General Clark says that compulsive and excessive use of social media platforms like Instagram can cause a wide range of harm to youth. And those include increased levels of anxiety and depression, reduced and interrupted sleep, increased suicidal thoughts and behaviors, and altered neurological and psychological development, including changes in brain structure, similar to changes seen in individuals with addiction to substances or gambling. There's a lot in there, but that last one in particular really struck me. Do you agree with that assessment?
I do. I think teenagers are especially vulnerable to things like addiction. It's teenage adolescent years are when a lot of mental health struggles start to kind of rear their heads as well. I think neurodevelopmentally, it makes sense, right? The areas of the brain that are responsible for seeking out rewarding things are a bit more active at that age than the areas of the brain that allow us to sort of put the brakes on those behaviors or to think about the consequences of our actions. And so it really illustrates sort of the vulnerability, especially of that age group, to a lot of things, especially, I think, the harmful effects of social media.
Mm. Now, one of the things we spoke about with Attorney General Clark is the challenge posed by showing direct causality between that feeling you get on social media and being able to say, this is Meta's fault or another company's fault. Yeah. They knew about this harmful effect and they promoted it, or whatever the exact argument might be. For you, as a psychiatrist, is there data out there that you can rely on to help you and your colleagues treat patients?
There's data out there, but most of the data is illustrating sort of the correlation between social media use and negative health outcomes and some positive health outcomes as well. And so it's, I think I would agree. I think it's really, really hard to find data that really identifies causation in general. So, but certainly I think the more that kids are using sort of the quantity of time, the quality of their use, how they're using social media, are all really important factors to consider.
Mm. Now, the suit also alleges that Instagram is disproportionately damaging to teen girls. Has that been true in your experience working with young people?
Anecdotally, yes. I would say that there is a certain vulnerability that is associated with teenage girls. And like Attorney General said, you can see a lot on Instagram. A lot of the photos, a lot of the stories are highly curated, right? They're not depicting sort of a reality, but that's not what teens are seeing. They're seeing a really sort of curated set of photos. And again, based in biology, a teenager is driven to respond to sort of that social pressure, that peer pressure to look a certain way, to be a certain way. And when that's so readily accessible through something like Instagram, I think it can be a really powerful tool.
Mm. Well, not to totally date myself, but I remember being a teen girl once and, you know, reading Teen Vogue or People magazine and like both loving those magazines, but also having adults in my ear constantly telling me, you know, that's not what your body has to look like. Like, that is not the ideal feminine beauty, but you still internalize it. And as when I was a teen, I knew lots of girls who struggled with body image disorder, anxiety, eating disorders. And I can imagine what it's like now when those images are just everywhere, not just in magazines.
Yeah, they're everywhere. Again, it's super accessible. And, you know, I'm responding to what you said about people in your ear kind of providing some perspective. I think a lot of parents, a lot of, you know, older adults, those of us with tweens ourselves, like, we have to educate ourselves in terms of what our kids are being exposed to, what's out there, because we really have to start having these conversations. Because, again, it's so readily accessible 24/7. I think it's incumbent on us to really be mindful of what our kids are engaged in.
Hmm. Well, let's bring one more voice into this conversation. Excuse me. Pearl Belomo is a junior at Vermont State University's Castleton campus and the managing editor of the campus newspaper, the Castleton Spartan. And just last month, she wrote an editorial about her decision to delete Instagram and TikTok and to pare down her time on other platforms. Pearl, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about your own personal history with social media. When did you get your own accounts for the first time?
Yeah. So I got certain platforms a little bit later than a lot of my peers. I got Snapchat, I think, when I was a sophomore in high school, and then Instagram and TikTok my junior, like, into senior years of high school, whereas a lot of my peers had those platforms right when they came out. So Snapchat, in that case, was more so in my middle school years, and Instagram and TikTok probably like middle school into freshman year of high school.
Mm. And what were your conversations like with your parents or caregivers when you got those accounts? Like, did they know?
They were very, very hesitant of me having accounts, especially Instagram and TikTok. Actually, they didn't even know I had them for the first year or so of me having them. But, you know, we worked it out. But still, yeah, they were concerned about just more so me being a public presence online.
Right. So you write in this editorial for the Castleton Spartan that you have decided to pare down your time on a couple of different platforms. Tell us about that decision.
Yeah, totally. So I wrote about how for a while, since I first got those accounts, I had taken pretty intermittent social media breaks. What I researched, what are called dopamine detoxes, because I just felt like I was just too attached to them. You know, I would be on platforms during work and just generally, I just felt more anxious. So I decided to completely get rid of my own personal Instagram account and my own personal TikTok this past summer.
Mm. What's it felt like since you did that?
Yeah. So I honestly feel, and other of my peers maybe don't agree with this or wouldn't have this experience, but I feel like my quality of life has improved. I talk about in my article about how just my quality of social interactions, I feel personally more fulfilled. Like, I feel like I get more out of them. I feel like I like to just have more side conversations throughout the day. Maybe, you know, talk to people, you know, a cashier at the grocery store I wouldn't normally. Or just like, I feel more focused throughout the day for homework or just like focusing on my own life and tasks.
Dr. Dickerson, are these types of social media detoxes something that you talk about with your patients or recommend?
Yeah, absolutely. I love the term dopamine detox. I think that's what you called it, Pearl. Yeah, because I think, again, it speaks to like the power of social media to sort of drive those behaviors. And it's so easy to get sucked in. And so taking a break can be associated with a lot of positive benefits, especially when you start to think about the balance between a sort of online time versus in-person, face-to-face time, and how the quality of those social interactions, like Pearl mentioned, are really different. And certainly social media can help cultivate, foster connectedness, in some positive ways, but for some teenagers, often that connectedness is rather empty and doesn't hold as much sort of richness and value as in-person interactions would.
Mm. Now, Pearl, the lawsuit against Meta that we were talking about earlier in the program alleges that Instagram's algorithm really pushes young people in particular towards increasingly distressing content sometimes to really maximize their engagement on the platform. So an example of that is if a girl sought information on weight loss or put in a search on Instagram, Instagram will then push them down dark holes of content that can promote extreme weight loss or eating disorders. And I'm curious if you or friends you've had have ever had experiences like that, not necessarily with that specific example I just shared, but feeling like you're kind of being pushed towards content that ultimately feels harmful.
Oh, definitely. I would definitely agree with that. You know, just content about young women and portrayal of that. Ideas about men and women or about social interactions. Specifically, I guess in my case, I would say that the news is very stimulating, whether that would be pop culture news or, you know, world news or national news, political news. Just every type of news is just very, like, catchy headlines, not usually the most accurate information. Or just in case of pop culture, you know, very stimulating toward, like, bringing down certain artists and celebrities, cancel culture, and also encouraging the youth to really be very passionate about, like, their responses to things and almost making them feel guilty if they don't feel overly passionate about, you know, something that should be, quote unquote, canceled.
Mm. Interesting. And I'm glad you brought up the news, Pearl, because I've been thinking in the last couple weeks, looking at my own Instagram feed, how difficult it is for me as an adult and a journalist to navigate all of the news that I'm seeing and decide what is accurate and what isn't. I'm thinking specifically right now of the situation in Israel and Gaza, seeing so many people on my social media feeds posting things, some of which feel true to their experience, others which feel like they might contain very inaccurate information. And it seems really hard for a young person, a 13-year-old or 14-year-old, to navigate and decide what is true and if they should post themselves. Dr. Dickerson, how can we help kids make those decisions?
Oh my gosh, it's really hard. Yeah. I think I would agree, Michaela, that even as an adult, I think it's really hard to sort of strike that balance between what we call like doom scrolling and just getting sucked into a lot of those negative news feeds and understanding the reality of the situation. Teenagers are driven by emotion. And again, that's sort of a product of their neurobiology. And so I think as adults, bringing attention to that potentially could be really helpful. Asking the question, the sort of quintessential psychiatry question, you know, how do you feel when you're looking at these images? How do you feel when you're spending a certain amount of time on Instagram or TikTok or Facebook or watching YouTube? And really starting those conversations with teenagers and kids early on and creating the space, I think, to be curious about that is really important.
Mm. Well, Pearl, before we let you go, since you're in a space as a junior in college right now where you can kind of serve as a bridge between the youngest folks who might be using social media and the adults who are trying to look out for them, do you have any tips for building a healthy social media presence or ways that you can use these platforms to feel good?
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, first and foremost, I think for me, you know, it was about focusing on my life and cultivating on my life and also like in-person interactions. So I think the key to striking a balance with social media is just to prioritize, you know, in-person life and things that pertain directly to you. And then use social media as a bridge from that, you know, as an extending, you know, send a video to a friend or, you know, like their posts or see what's going on in the news. But mainly just focus on your life and try to find reliable sources. A good way to at least indicate if something's reliable, it's hard to ensure, but see that things aren't, you know, overly emotional. Try to find news sources that don't seem like they're completely taking one side. You know, try to find things that are somewhat nuanced. Mm.
Well, Pearl Belomo, we're so glad that you could join us. Pearl is a junior at Vermont State University's Castleton campus and the managing editor of the Castleton Spartan. If you go to their website, you can find her recent editorial about how she is handling social media these days. Pearl, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Let's get back to our conversation on social media and young people. Our guest is Dr. Jeremiah Dickerson, an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Vermont Larner College of Medicine and a practicing child and adolescent psychiatrist. Dr. Dickerson, I don't think I've ever felt older than using the phrase young people. Right. I wrote it for myself. I have no one to blame but myself. Let's go to the phones. We have a call from Harry in Cornish, New Hampshire. Harry, how are you doing?
Good. How are you doing, Michaela?
Doing well. What's your question or your thoughts?
Well, I've been hearing a lot of negativity. I know this whole conversation is nuanced, and I'm myself, as a 59-year-old, I'm kind of torn with social media because I love it. I mean, I love Instagram. I think it's a great outlet for creatives, and I think if you limit yourself, you know, just give yourself 40 minutes every day. But I know that's hard for young people to do that. So it's complicated. And I think you said nuanced. That's a great word. And I think it is nuanced. But can you guys talk about some of the positive things about social media? This seems to be a heavy one-sided kind of dialogue. And I myself find it, especially Instagram, I think it's fantastic for artists.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Harry, for bringing that up. And I think our previous guest, Pearl Belomo, had some great suggestions for ways to use Instagram as a way to connect and to not take over too much of your life. Dr. Dickerson, what are your thoughts? Where do you see social media helping the young people that you work with?
Yeah, I agree. I think we can't sort of demonize social media altogether, that there are certain benefits for certain kids and teenagers. It's super individualized. And it's all about finding that balance. So I think there really is benefit in terms of creativity, in terms of connection, in terms of learning. But we have to think about when the sort of benefits start to impede on a child or teenager's sort of day-to-day functioning, to go to school, to ensure that they're getting a certain amount of sleep so that they are able to engage day to day in their learning face to face in person. So it's really hard. And I think teenagers, again, by virtue of their biology, have a hard time setting limits themselves on their social media use. So again, it's really incumbent on the adults in their life to model those healthy habits, provide them with avenues to find, you know, platforms that do function in terms of cultivating that creativity while also acknowledging that the risks are there as well.
Hmm. I can also imagine that in a rural state like Vermont or a rural region, social media can be a way that marginalized kids can connect with one another.
Absolutely. And in my own practice, thinking about sort of the gender diverse kids and teenagers that I see, social media has been a lifeline. I have to say, I think it's probably saved a few lives in terms of kids finding community, engaging in sort of affinity spaces that allow them to ask questions and to get information that can inform their development and their identity in a positive and healthy way.
Hmm. Well, you've talked a bit about the importance of being a good role model. Do you have any specific suggestions for parents and caregivers, maybe ones that you've practiced yourself in your own home on how to model good behavior?
Yeah, sure. I will acknowledge that it's hard. And, you know, there's no easy solution to this. Thinking about sort of the influence of social media and screen time for all of us day to day, it's not going away anytime soon, right? So I think we have to be really mindful of our own use and sort of when we're holding on to our own phones and when we're just sort of mindlessly scrolling while we're at the dinner table or hanging out with our children. Finding that balance is really important. So thinking about, again, sort of how social media can really influence that dopamine. It can be really rewarding for teenagers. Think about what else can sort of influence that dopamine in a kid's brain, in a teenager's brain. Physical activity, other sort of creative outlets, encouraging, again, face-to-face time and connectedness with their friends and family as well.
Mm. Well, one thing I can imagine that would be difficult with teens, though, is that you want to give them their own level of autonomy and privacy.
Yes.
And what goes on in a kid's bedroom is their own business.
Yep.
And they might be, you know, scrolling on Instagram from, you know, midnight to 2 a.m. Like, and on one hand, I can see benefits to you know, keeping the phone out of the room or putting some rules on there, checking in on them, but you also want to encourage some independence.
Yeah, I again, another sort of nuanced sort of a component of this. I think it's helpful to think about kids sort of earning privilege, right? If they can demonstrate that they are responsible consumers in terms of not just screen time in general, but using social media, I think if they're able to demonstrate that, that responsibility may come with increasing privilege around that. But I think when, you know, tweens, especially sort of that 10 to 13 year old age range, parents should be very mindful about their own child's privacy and making it clear from the beginning, like, hey, I'm going to take a look at your phone every now and then and get a sense of what you're doing, because I need to know that you're safe. And if you're able to demonstrate that you're safe and responsible, then we can talk about sort of backing away as a parent.
Well, we're speaking with practicing child and adolescent psychiatrist, Dr. Jeremiah Dickerson. If you have questions for him, give us a call, 800-639-2211. Do you have any suggestions of how old kids could be, should be, when they start getting their own social media accounts? I know there's like rules from these platforms,
sure,
but they're not always followed.
I mean, my advice is to push it off as long as humanly possible for kids and teenagers. It's really hard. I think teenagers especially are feeling the pressure a lot of the time to post, to join certain platforms. But I think it's very individualized to families in terms of what, you know, how much scrutiny you're able to provide for a certain child and teenager. So it's really hard. You know, we have 11-year-old twins who just got their own smartphones this year for their birthday. They don't have access to social media yet. But even just, you know, setting limits around screen time and use of their phone has been really, really challenging. So I appreciate that there's no sort of easy solution to all of this.
What did it feel like for you as a parent to get your kids' phones?
It's a mixed bag, I will say. You know, being a parent and a child psychiatrist,
I know too much.
It's really interesting. And I think, you know, we were pretty mindful just about having open conversations about the potential risks and creating space for that and continuing to ask questions and to educate ourselves as parents in terms of what's out there, what are the new platforms, what are kids able and not able to see, et cetera. I mean, a lot of kids and teenagers are very tech savvy and probably much more savvy than us parents. And so, setting those limits are important. Being aware of the apps that are out there to help parents set limits on their kids' phone use and what they're potentially looking at, I think, are also important as well.
Well, Dr. Dickerson, what do you think the role of government should be when we're trying to figure out ways to solve this problem? We've talked a lot about what you could do at the level of the family in your own home. But what about, you know, a couple levels up? Like, for example, cell phone bans in schools.
Mm-hmm. Again, another sort of very nuanced topic, Michaela. I don't sort of support 100% ban on cell phones in schools. Again, there's a balance to be struck. This digital technology is not going away. I think if we lean towards a ban, it can really influence like a child's trust or a student's trust in their parents and their teachers. Like, you don't trust us enough to manage this. So I think the focus should be on how do we teach kids the skills and teenagers the skills to sort of regulate their use rather than, again, viewing it through the lens of this is all 100% negative.
I know that, you know, over the last couple of years, we have covered on Vermont Edition and on NPR
the growing, it seems, mental health crisis among young people and kids.
Yeah.
As somebody working in this field, how have you seen that shift? Are you getting more requests for help than you can address as an individual practitioner?
Yeah, I think, you know, thinking about just child psychiatry in general, yes, the number of referrals has gone up. I think the wait to find mental health professionals for kids and teenagers is also increasing as well. I think the pandemic has really highlighted children's mental health in a positive way. Like, it's starting a lot more conversation. It's influencing a lot more dialogue around this topic, which is great. And I think social media platforms also kind of can cultivate positive dialogue around this as well, thinking about sort of celebrity disclosures and the power of that and what teenagers are especially exposed to. But yeah, there more and more kids are demonstrating mental health problems. And I think we have to start thinking really creatively about how best to address this.
Hmm. Do you have suggestions of creative solutions there? Like, for example, if there's a parent who's been trying to find somebody who can work with their family or their kid and hasn't been able to find anybody with an opening in Vermont, what's the next best step?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, again, one of the more positive elements of technology is a lot of folks are working remotely. And so using platforms to access mental health care with professionals could provide benefit, especially if there's families, kids, and teenagers who wouldn't otherwise be able to access such support. And so, again, thinking about some of the positive aspects of this is important.
Mm. Are you talking about platforms like BetterHelp, which I think anyone who's listened to a podcast is
potentially. I think people have to be really aware of sort of the logistics of it all and sort of who they're talking to and what sort of the credentials are of those folks offering those types of services. But it could be very useful for some people.
Well, Dr. Dickerson, let's try to end here on a positive note, if we could. For folks listening, particularly young people out there listening, could you share with us a couple suggestions of or stories of ways in which you have heard social media usage, you know, in a young person that you've worked with improve due to, you know, specific decisions that they or a family has made?
Yeah, I think, again, just starting conversations can be really influential. There's data to indicate that teenagers are looking for parents and other caregivers to help them set limits on their use of screens, on their use of social media. And so just asking the question, hey, what are you looking at? And again, how does this make you feel? I think are two really important questions for parents to ask their children. And again, approaching it in a curious sort of non-judgmental manner is really important as well. We don't want to shame this. Again, it's here to stay. And so really just leveraging the benefits and trying to figure that out is important.
Mm. Well, Dr. Jeremiah Dickerson, thank you so much for joining us, talking us through this difficult topic today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Dickerson is an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Vermont Larner College of Medicine and a practicing child and adolescent psychiatrist.